morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Amidst all the swirl, agony, and tragedy of the coronavirus, aka COVID-19, pandemic that has struck us like a cosmic scythe, it would be grossly remiss to forget this equinoctial, which is, of course, an astronomic term for equality. Month of March is the annual observance of Women's Her Story. And today, March 26th, is exactly 6 months from the day 100 years ago when American women were finally officially certified as able to vote in the USA, a right of citizenship denied them in the U.S. Constitution. On August 26, 1920, the 19th Amendment was ratified. The 19th Amendment states simply, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex." Called the Anthony Amendment, in honor of its major author, Susan B. Anthony, it was introduced and reintroduced into Congress for 41 years, from 1878 to 1919, until it was finally passed and became law. Its namesake, Susan Anthony, declared when she and 16 other women suffragists were arrested in Rochester, New York, for attempting to vote in the 1872 presidential election, which ironically featured the first woman candidate, Victoria Woodhull, who campaigned on the People's Party ticket, quote, "It is we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people, who formed this union. We formed it not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them, not to the half of ourselves and the half of our posterity, but to the whole people, women as well as men. It is downright mockery to talk of women of their enjoyment of the blessings of liberty while they are denied the only means of securing them provided by the Democratic Republican government, the ballot." Unquote. And that was by Susan B. Anthony. Anthony's arrest, trial, and sentence to a fine which she refused to pay were a cause celebre. Many other women suffragists followed her example until the Supreme Court ruled against them. She did not live to see the Anthony Amendment finally grant women the vote. She died in 1906. Neither, for that matter, did her most earnest cohort and best friend from when they met at a women's temperance meeting in 1851, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who died in 1902. In commemoration of women's victory of the vote a century ago, which was declared Women's Equality Day in 1982 by President Ronald Reagan, who conversely opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, I now read an article Leonora Murray wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1979, the 26th of August. August 26th is not just another summer day. It is a day of remembrance, a special day honoring three generations of American women who successfully campaigned for 72 years and finally won the basic right of citizenship, the right to vote. The 19th Amendment became a part of the United States Constitution on August 26, 1920. After 72 years of struggle, American women have had suffrage for 100 years. One wonders how long it will take to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Susan B. Anthony went to jail because she attempted to vote. A federal judge told her citizen did not mean women. If we meant women, we would say women. So who says we don't need the ERA? I think all of us on the North Coast have feminist ancestors who endured ridicule, derision, distortion, verbal and physical assaults to gain equality. We all have grandmothers, mothers, aunts, sisters, wives, daughters, sweethearts, and cousins, women who got thrown in jail for joining strikes, who got fired when asking for equal wages, who were denied access to training and education on the basis of sex, who marched and demonstrated, who still march and demonstrate. Will you remember them on August 26th? Let's remember our folk heroes, the women who attended the first Equal Rights Conference in New York and published the Seneca Falls Declaration in 1848, the women who joined the Women's Party that Alice Paul founded, the women who were blue-collar workers and union organizers. Let's remember them all with love. Let's celebrate. Let's celebrate the gutsy Dr. Mary Wright, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. She was a battlefield surgeon for the Union Army. 50 years later, Congress decided she hadn't been brave enough, so they requested the medal be returned. She refused, so Congress denied her military pension. Unfortunately, nobody bothered to take down her exact words, but they must have been dillies to make Congress take such strong action against her. After all, she was still a veteran, entitled to her pension. Let's celebrate ex-slave Sojourner Truth. Her speech, "Ain't I a Woman," made history when she asked, if women were frail and weak, how come nobody kept her from working as a field hand? And if motherhood and women's sensitivity precluded them from public life, then where was everybody when her 5 children were sold into slavery? Nobody worried about her sensitivity, and "Ain't I a Woman?" She sure was. And in another instance, she faced down a Bible-quoting mob, saying she did indeed believe in Jesus. But you men didn't have nothing to do with Jesus. That was between God and women. No men anywhere. A very nice lady. A very tough lady. And let's not forget Sacagawea, pathfinder for Lewis and Clark, or Luch Stone, who made up her own wedding vows and kept her own name, or Jane Addams, not only a great humanitarian, but first American to win the Nobel Prize, and who insisted that her husband realize that more than just men were equal, or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or Abigail Adams, or Oregon's own Agnes Thecla Fair, Abigail Scott Dunaway, Dr. Marie Acqui, Julia Rutella, or Amelia Bloomer, who tried so damn hard to make sense out of fashion. Now that lady would be in rat heaven to see jeans as an acceptable garment. I think our libraries need at least one set of American women of history, her story. Without it, the women I mentioned are just a splash in the ocean. And most of all, let's celebrate the grand old lady, Susan B. Anthony, who said, "Failure is impossible." We believe it. If it takes another 72 years to get women written into the National Constitution and consciousness, we're ready. But I don't think our politicians are. Stanton didn't forget men either. On men's liberation, she said, "Of course, for are not men the children of women?" And most heartening and solemn of all, Susan B. Anthony said, "Until women have the same rights as men on this green earth, there shall never be another season of silence." Amen. Let's all support our local daycare centers. Join the local chapter of the National Organization for Women now. Support our women's crisis centers. And best of all, celebrate our gallant women. August 26th, celebrate the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. And that was the 26th of August by Leah Nora Murray, who wrote this article to celebrate the 60th anniversary of women's right to vote for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1980. I just kicked it up 40 years. And of course, the Equal Rights Amendment very much needs a restart, not when, but now. Carrie Chapman Catt and Nettie Rogers wrote a book in 1923, Women, Suffrage, and Politics, The Inner Story of the Suffrage Movement, in which they asked, why the delay? "We think we have the answer," they wrote. It was not an antagonistic public sentiment, nor yet an uneducated or indifferent public sentiment. It was the control of public sentiment, the deflecting and thwarting of public sentiment through the trading and the trickery, the buying and selling of American politics. We think that we can prove it. It should be understood that the long, exhaustive fight for women's suffrage was hardly entirely legislative. It involved many thousands of marches, demonstrations, and rallies, which were numerous times violently disrupted by rioting men, club-swinging police, and massive arrests of women and male supporters. And almost immediately after the suffrage victory, another crucial and long-drawn-out struggle for the equality of women began. At a National Women's Party convention in 1921, Alice Paul introduced what she said was the next women's rights issue, passage of an Equal Rights Amendment. In 1923, the NWP, the National Women's Party, started a new journal, Equal Rights, edited by Edith Houghton Hooker, and introduced its Equal Rights Amendment, nicknamed the Lucretia Mott Amendment, into Congress. This bill, which failed, stated, "Men and women shall have equal rights throughout the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction." Many women's groups and labor activists opposed the bill because it eliminated hard-won protective legislation for women workers. Indeed, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated a minimum wage law because it did not give men and women equal rights. Reintroduced into the House of Representatives by Congresswoman Hattie Caraway 20 years later, in 1943, the ERA was changed to read, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." Again failing to pass, women in several states set up ERA committees that lobbied state legislatures to pressure Congress. The Senate voted on the ERA for the first time in more than 20 years in 1947. The count of 38 for and 35 against was far short of the two-thirds majority needed. In 1967, the National Organization for Women, NOW, made as one of eight demands included in its Bill of Rights, immediate passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, quote unquote. Finally, in 1970, the House approved the ERA, 350-15, after only an hour debate following Representative Martha Griffiths' successful effort to get it out of the Judiciary Committee. But the Senate refused to vote on the ERA until 1972, following intense lobbying by women's groups, especially NOW. The measure was approved 84-8. By the end of the year, 22 states led by Hawaii ratified the amendment. In addition, six states, Colorado, Hawaii, Maryland, New Mexico, Washington, and Texas, added equal rights amendments to their state constitutions, preceded by Pennsylvania the year before. However, by 1978, Congress was urged to extend the ratification deadline beyond March 1979 because a shortfall of 35 out of required 38 states had ratified the ERA. Seven more years were requested, but Congress extended the deadline only 4 years to June 30, 1982. ERA supporters not only fought campaigns to pass ERA in the states, but also campaigns to rescind it. In 1979, NOW and other groups managed to head off attempts to revoke ERA ratification in 13 states, but were unable to gain any new states. The necessary three states never ratified the ERA, although polls showed that 63% of the public supported it, with only 32% opposed. 15 states rejected the ERA, and four others attempted to rescind their support, but the move was thought to be unconstitutional. Among the spurious arguments used to defeat the ERA were the specter of women being drafted and forced to serve in combat, a potential loss of alimony and child custody preference in divorce cases, and the possibility that tax money would have to be used for abortions. Anti-feminists also put forth absurd but highly symbolic scenarios, such as unisex toilets. Right-wing women such as Phyllis Schlafly and her Eagle Forum, dedicated to family values, quote-unquote, and law and order, also, quote-unquote, considerably upset the ERA campaign. The ERA failed even though it had majority support throughout the country. The ERA has been prematurely sent to the grave more than once since 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, 51 U.S. senators and 201 House representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law within a few months. Instead, when revived again, and it will be, it must once more travel the tortuously long trail through the states, 38 of whom must ratify it into law. Even the most optimistic believe it will take years. One possibility to encourage the process of making the ERA a part of the Constitution is for women to vote all who oppose it from office and support only candidates who will endorse it. As Eleanor Schmiel, former head of NOW, wrote in 1982, "The best way to assure recognition of women's political concerns is to elect office holders who are not only pro-women's issues, but are women themselves. The quickest way for us to elect more women to public office is for more women to run as candidates." And that was Eleanor Schmiel. An excellent reason for women to get into politics is that they generally represent the most generous and humane prospects of humanity. Women are literally pregnant with our future and provide the true compassion and Gaia wisdom of our species. In the words of Susan B. Anthony, "There shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green earth." And now, again, something I've written, a declaration of sentiments. The deceit that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic throughout history, especially in periods when muscle and brute force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human yearning. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took nearly half a century for American women to gain the right to vote after it was, at long last, allowed to be introduced to Congress in 1878, exactly 91 years after the U.S. Constitution was adopted. The nation has been saddled with the swagger of blustering maleness despite a popular majority of women voters whose political endeavors are too often denied by fraud and corruption at virtually every level of male assertion of power. Women have contributed hugely to American history, but as with blacks and others who have helped build this nation, their contributions have been ignored, undervalued, or simply displaced. In the summer of 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention, perhaps the most famous gathering of American women in the 19th century, was held in Seneca Falls, New York. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was to meet and befriend Susan B. Anthony 3 years later in 1851, Lucretia Mott, Martha Coffin Wright, Jane Hunt, and Mary Ann McClintock were the principal organizers and were surprised that nearly 300 people, mostly women, but a few notable men, including Frederick Douglass, freed slave and black abolitionist, attended. A declaration of sentiments was drafted by Elizabeth Stanton at the convention, modeled after the Declaration of Independence. According to the North Star, an abolitionist newspaper published by Frederick Douglass, the document was the grand movement for attaining the civil, social, political, and religious rights of women. So now, a declaration of sentiments, which was signed by 100 women and men who attended the conference, 68 women and 32 men. The Declaration of Sentiments, opening paragraphs. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that which they have hitherto occupied, but one to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to such a course. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these rights, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it, and to insist upon the institution of a new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of women under this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpation on the part of man toward women, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpation on the part of man toward women, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her. Now, in view of this entire disenfranchisement of one half the people of this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws meant, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of these United States. In entering upon the great work before us, we anticipate no small amount of misconception, misrepresentation, and ridicule, but we shall use every instrumentality within our power to effect our object. We shall employ agents, circulate tracts, petition the state and national legislatures, and endeavor to enlist the pulpit and the press in our behalf. We hope this convention will be followed by a series of conventions embracing every part of the country. That was the prologue and the closing remarks of the Declaration of Sentiments by Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And now, from Robert Brake, Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington, celebrating two women. Tomorrow, March 27th, marks the anniversary of the death of Catherine Lee Bates, American writer, poet, scholar, and social activist, who composed America the Beautiful, our signature patriotic song. In these troubled times, I can think of no song that better captures the greatness and spirit of America. America the Beautiful was composed in 1893 when Bates stood at Pike's Peak overlooking Purple Mountain majesties and amber waves of grain. Some congressmen and women have deemed America a hymn, a prayer, and even the national heartbeat music, quote-unquote, suitable to replace the Star-Spangled Banner with this more lyrical, less militaristic timbre. The song seems ubiquitous. America is sung in multiple languages, even in reform schools and prisons. When I first heard the late Ray Charles' stunning rendition of America, I heard him launch his majestic recording, not with spacious skies and amber waves, but with a darker fifth stanza which reads, "O beautiful for heroes proved in liberating strife." Charles chose to focus on the huge sacrifices necessary to preserve the sweet America he loved so much. That version seemed oh so right to me. I sometimes forget the men and women who died for my freedom. It's hard for me to fully grasp their bravery and conviction to the freedom I and others sometimes take for granted. Interestingly, I discovered that Catherine Lee Bates chose to downplay the sacrifices Americans had made to achieve our abundance and exceptionalism. But perhaps that's owing to the fact that America was experiencing a depression in 1893 when she composed her famous poem. I've always valued Ray Charles's reflections on the wrongs America has undergone, while also focusing on her beauty and greatness. Charles also asked for God's guidance so we could use the gifts he gave us for good. That eloquently defines what I consider the real roots of America. Set to music by Silas G. Pratt and rewritten in 1904, America captured my heart and the hearts of countless Americans, moving us to tears and a real sense of patriotism. On January 18, 2017, the New York Times quoted President Barack Obama, who declared that the Ray Charles version of America, quote, would always be the most patriotic piece of music ever performed, unquote. I'm thankful for Bates' inspired efforts and Ray Charles' splendid rendition, because America the Beautiful conveys an attitude of appreciation and gratitude for our country's extraordinary beauty and abundance without mean-spirited nationalism and triumphalism. The day after Ray Charles died, June 10, 2004, salon writer Charles Taylor remarked, "Ray Charles's version of America the Beautiful remains the least boastful of patriotic songs, and even so, his version teaches us all a new humility." I find that beautiful. And since March is Women's History Month, I extend kudos to New Zealander Jacinda Ardern, a 39-year-old prime minister who has earned international acclaim for her leadership in the face of tragedy and articulated a form of leadership that embodies strength and sanity while also pushing for an agenda of compassion and community. After the March 15, 2019 tragedy, when gunmen killed 51 worshippers at a Christ Church mosque, Ardern moved swiftly to propose New Zealand's first meaningful gun legislation in decades. When some seemed to feel powerless and disenfranchised, Ardern spoke up at a February 7, 2020 interview, declaring, "We can either stoke it with fear and blame, or we can respond by taking some responsibility and giving some hope that our democratic institutions, our politicians, actually do something about what they're feeling." And that's a quote. While New Zealand has set moral precedents on several fronts, the first country to give women the vote, the first to introduce some form of social security for its elderly, and the first to ban vessels carrying nuclear weapons from entering its waters, it yet faces many leadership challenges and domestic setbacks for Ardern. But her authenticity and compassion may yet prevail. Speaking of Ardern, Mike Moore, former head of the World Trade Organization, said, "Leadership is more than finding an angry crowd and agreeing with it." I'm looking forward to more of Jacinta Ardern's inspirational, pragmatic idealism. Those are just two inspirational women I'm pleased to honor during National Women's History Month. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake, from Ocean Park, Washington, celebrating two women. This is Michael McCusker. 2 days ago, March 24th, was the birthday of Helen Patty Hill, who provided KMUN with its home and Oregon adoptees their birthright and identity at the millennium's dawn. President Donald Trump is convinced that the patriotic duty of Americans is to risk life, limb, and pestilence to save the economy, which is not quite as inspirational as final sacrifice for God, country, and democracy. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everyone else.